31 degrees. It's 10:06. This is WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. Congress marked the new year with votes to avert the so-called fiscal cliff. The Senate passed a bill 89-8 in the early morning hours of January 1st that made the Bush tax cuts permanent for all but the wealthiest Americans. It extended unemployment benefits for a year, along with a variety of other tax credits, reinstated the full payroll tax, and put off decisions about cuts in defense and domestic spending until later in the winter. The House Republicans balked at first, but then passed the bill 257-167 late last night with a majority of Republicans voting no, although House Speaker John Boehner supported the bill. President Obama had this to say last night after the House vote.
The one thing that I think hopefully in the new year we'll focus on is seeing if we can put a package like this together with a little bit less drama, a little less brinksmanship, not scare the heck out of folks quite as much.
We begin our discussion today with Ed O'Keefe, who covers Congress for The Washington Post. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times, Ed.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Looking at yesterday, and I have to say I was following this online late in the afternoon into the early evening, it looked like the House was either going to reject this bill or amend it. What happened that they passed it?
Well, in the end, they realized that it made more sense just to pass it up or down and get it done before the stock markets opened Wednesday morning than to attempt to amend it and send it back to the Senate. And the reason is that they knew that if they attempted to amend this bill, it would basically kill the deal and all responsibility would rest with them for having scuttled what was, until the House voted, a bipartisan deal. And when the House voted, became an even bigger bipartisan deal.
Was there someone that told them this, or was this a collective figuring out of the politics of this?
It was a little bit of both. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, had signaled that if the House tried to do this, the Senate wasn't necessarily going to take it up. They might not even be in town to do it. He didn't completely shutter the 112th Congress, but he did sort of signal that they would not take it up. And I think looking at the 89-vote margin that this bill had in the Senate, the fact that so many conservative Republican senators voted for it gave House Republicans a reason to go along with this, even if they had to hold their nose.
Well, let me go back to the Senate, and we have a kind of a funky phone line here. But let me carry on with you, Ed, and hopefully we can fix this as we speak. But even going back to the Senate vote, and what we learned was that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Vice President Joe Biden were the negotiators. Were negotiating this deal. What does that tell us about their relationship? Do we not have him? All right, let's get Ed O'Keefe back on the line, and we will call him up. And just to recap here, we are fixing our phone lines, but we're also talking about yesterday's vote, both in the House and the Senate, to avert the so-called fiscal cliff. And I do believe that we have Ed O'Keefe back. Ed, are you with us?
I am.
Okay, great. I'm glad we're reconnected. This was my question about Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden. How come they negotiated this deal in the Senate?
Well, in the end, it was left up to them because they were really the only two that could do it. These are guys that served for more than two decades together in the Senate, had a good relationship. It wasn't like a buddy-buddy relationship, as they had said, but it was the kind of relationship that allowed them to do business. And in the end, because the president couldn't cut a deal with House Speaker John Boehner, because House Speaker John Boehner and Harry Reid couldn't work something out, because Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell couldn't work something out, Mitch McConnell picked up the phone on Sunday, called his old friend Joe Biden, and said, let's make a deal. And the vice president, who until Sunday really had been on the sidelines, had been put there by the White House in hopes that the president could cut the deal, very quickly stood up an agreement with Mitch McConnell and then spent most of Sunday night, Monday and Tuesday selling this to skeptical Democrats who have almost universally praised him for jumping in at the last minute, studying this issue very well, and then in the end emotionally, passionately selling it to them.
As you wrote today, do you think the fact that we had two 70-year-olds, as you said, with almost 70 years of experience negotiating this, tells us something about the importance of relationships in Congress?
Absolutely it does. And that is what observers of Congress have feared ever since the Tea Party Congress was elected, that this new wave of younger people who don't necessarily have legislative experience, don't know how to forge relationships across the aisle, might lead to all this gridlock. And in the end, it took two statesmen who have worked together, who have been there for bipartisan agreements in the past, to cut this monumental deal.
And looking at the Republicans in the House that voted against this deal, what are their objections?
Well, primarily that there aren't spending cuts involved in this. While taxes are cut, while the estate tax is maintained as is, while the AMT tax is patched pretty much permanently, there was no significant cut in spending included as part of this, and that is a fight now that will have to be held essentially in the next 2 to 3 months when when the debt ceiling is expected to be exceeded and when the current short-term spending agreement that is funding the federal government expires at the end of March. So, you know, a lot of them just simply voted for it on that because they had been elected on the principle of shrinking the size of the federal government. This bill, as big and high profile as it was, did nothing to do that, and so they just decided to vote against it.
Are there some unhappy Democrats?
There are, because for one thing, the tax threshold is much higher than the president had campaigned on and that many of them had campaigned on. And there's also, primarily, big concern about what comes next. Because the president gave in on tax rates and because he left the fate of the so-called sequester and the debt ceiling out there for the next few months, there's big concern among liberal Democrats that the president is going to have to cede even more ground, especially on spending, and especially on spending for discretionary domestic programs that are of importance to a lot of their constituents. You know, we spoke, for example, with urban Democratic congressman yesterday who said, look, you know, homelessness programs, for example, always targeted by Republicans in these spending cut debates, but I need that for my district right now, especially with the economy still sputtering. That's what my concern is that the president or the Democratic leaders might sell away those programs in hopes of boosting Pentagon spending and getting enough Republican support. But they said in the same breath, Vice President Biden came here, told us that, yes, it wasn't in this bill, but no, we're not going to cede ground on this in the debate to come. And you heard the president say last night, very late, that when it comes to the debt ceiling, he's not going to negotiate on raising it based on making government spending.
You wrote, and there are apparently 153 pages of small print in this bill, but you also wrote about the use of riders. Tell us what a rider is and what some of the riders in this bill are.
Yeah, a rider is essentially kind of like the, I think the way we described it was it's kind of like a stowaway. You know, you tuck certain things into these bills to sweeten the deal for certain members. So you had things like, you know, a provision, a tax on imported rum. The U.S. government funnels this primarily to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. There are people there who oppose it, but it's there. There were provisions renewing the Agriculture Department's price support program, which essentially made sure that milk prices won't go up, at least for not another 9 months. There was a language in there that blocked a pay increase, a very modest cost of living adjustment that Congress was going to get along with federal employees. Congress said, thanks, but no thanks. But really, the only reason the president ever had to issue that cost of living increase was because Congress itself hadn't actually sorted out what pay scales were going to be like for the government in this new calendar year. And there were other sort of smaller, more technical things, tax breaks, for example, for NASCAR tracks and other extenders that are the types of things that have been targeted by conservatives who want to, you know, cut spending and reduce this kind of looniness that the federal government participates in, but also among those who just sort of say, this is what Congress has to do to pass things, that's ridiculous. But there again, and again, that's a bit of an old-school move. But Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden knew that in order to get something like this passed, the bill was going to require a few of these riders.
And a rider is different from an earmark, not to get into the weeds here?
It is, because earmarks specifically denote spending on certain projects in different districts or in different states. This is things like, you know, a tax cut here for a certain group of people or, you know, that decision to freeze or not take the cost of living increase for members of Congress, which made it politically palpable for certain people to vote for it, to say, you know, I did this, and not only did I do it, but I didn't raise my pay.
Is there any significance that John Boehner voted to yes and Eric Cantor voted no on this bill?
Absolutely, because it demonstrates the divide in the Republican caucus in the House, that it spread so far as the leadership. Eric Cantor yesterday announced around midday that he didn't like this deal, and that sent many of us scrambling because we were convinced that if the majority leader of the House sets the schedule and brings bills to the floor didn't like it, that it probably wasn't going to happen. But within minutes, we heard that the Speaker, John Boehner, had decided, look, I'm just here to listen to my members. I haven't made a decision, which suggested that he was still in support of this because, remember, he had said that if the Senate passed the bipartisan deal and brought it to the House, the House would vote on it, and so it appeared he was holding to that. In the end, the Speaker cast a vote for it that's rare. The Speaker actually traditionally doesn't vote on legislation, just kind of stands back and doesn't have to vote. But in this case, he did to signal that he supported this deal. Moments after the vote crossed the 217 majority threshold, there were a sizable number of Democrats who cast their vote almost at the same time and took the bill over the 217 margin. Within moments, Eric Cantor casted his no vote. So did the House Majority Whip, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican of California, who's responsible for counting votes and knowing how things are going to go. He also voted no and had spent most of the day on the House floor stone-faced, really kind of resigned to the fact that this was going to happen, and happen in a way that violates House Republican principles. There's been a rule in place since Dennis Hastert was the Speaker that sort of says that we're not going to bring anything to the floor that a majority of our party doesn't plan to vote for. And this certainly was the biggest, most high-profile violation of that rule that Boehner has, for the most part, kept to since he was elected Speaker in 2011.
Well, a couple more minutes before we have to say goodbye to you, Ed, but obviously two big issues on the horizon, one having to do with spending cuts. Do you anticipate the same kind of, I don't even know what to call it, negotiations that we just observed?
Yeah, someone was calling them fiscal crestfalls, I think.
And, is that
and
what
there
it
are
is?
Three, essentially, now facing Congress in the next 3 months. So buckle in, you know, pour the coffee and,
yeah,
and get
exactly.
ready for another more exciting ride. We have three things facing us now. There's going to be a fight over the debt ceiling. As of Monday, the Treasury Department says the federal debt ceiling has been exceeded, and they're now taking what they call extraordinary measures to keep the government funded. Folks, don't worry. There's money there to be played with, and they'll have it through about the end of February. So that fight has to come. We remember how that went last summer, in the summer of 2011, where there was this fight about raising it and then cutting government spending. Again, the president said late Sunday, we're going to raise the debt ceiling. I'm not negotiating on this issue with agreeing to cut spending. But he might have to agree to cut spending when it comes to the sequester, these automatic budget cuts that took effect yesterday on Tuesday. I believe it's, what, $50 billion in Pentagon spending that's taking effect in the next few months, $50 billion in domestic spending that's also being cut. Federal agencies here in Washington and across the country now trying to figure out, what do I have to cut? Who do I have to furlough? What programs do I have to potentially put on hold or cancel? There's an agreement to get this done by the end of March as well. And then also at the end of March, the current short-term, what they call continuing resolution, which funds the federal government, is set to expire. Everyone will remember back in April of 2011, there was a fight over this and almost led to a government shutdown. So potentially we face another credit downgrade, another government shutdown, and another fight just in general about government spending and the philosophies of how big and how broad-sweeping the federal government should be.
Well, I know what you'll be doing for the next couple of months. Ed O'Keefe.
Don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us as well. He covers Congress for the Washington Post. We will continue our conversation talking about what we're calling fiscal cliff politics. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA Continuing Education invites you to join their community of artists of all ages and levels this spring, featuring day, evening, and weekend art classes, pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, and master workshops with noted artists. Registration is now open, and classes begin January 22nd. For details, pafa.edu/ce.
This week in This American Life, five stories about the five ways to know the world. Sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell. Yes, smell. Cyrano Industries is making an electronic nose plus stuff for it to sniff.
You're culturing bad breath here yourself. You're sort of, you know, growing bad breath so that you can get the nose to recognize it?
Yes, we're growing the components of bad breath.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Love him or hate him, you can't forget him. Comedian Jimmy Walker and his most famous character, J.J. Evans, and that catchphrase, dynamite. Now he says there was always a method to his foolishness.
You have to be the person who takes the pie. If you're not willing to take the pie, you're not going to be noticed.
Our conversation with Jimmy Walker, that's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about what the fiscal cliff negotiations tells us about the state of affairs between Republicans and Democrats in Washington, D.C., and our political system. And joining us now is Ross Baker. He's a professor of political science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He was scholar in residence in the office of the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, Democratic Senator Harry Reid, and has previously advised Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate, also a member of the Board of Contributors of USA Today. And Ross Baker, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure, Marty.
Nice to have you here and Happy New Year. Also with us is Bill Galston. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Also served as deputy assistant to President Clinton for domestic policy from 93 to 1999. Also one of the founders of No Labels. That's a political organization of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. Their stated mission is to address the politics of problem solving. And Bill Galston, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure, Marty.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Ross Baker. Looking at the last couple of days, and including yesterday on New Year's Day, were we witnessing business as usual in Congress, or a dysfunctional, even irresponsible Congress?
Well, I think if they'd been completely dysfunctional, completely irresponsible, they would have gone home and not dealt with this at all. I think it's very difficult to be a defender of Congress, especially when it habitually works up against the deadline, as in this case, and especially when it comes up with solutions which really don't deal entirely with the problems. I mean, for example, you know, clearly we've gotten off the cliff, but we're heading for the abyss.
Yes,
with the debt limit problem at the end of February. So, but I think that there were people who were willing to walk the plank. I think especially in the Senate, I think that the bipartisan vote in the Senate was a resounding success in terms of bringing people together, which I think is a lot easier in the Senate than it is in the House. But even in the House, a much more partisan institution, you had a number of 85 Republicans supporting the Speaker, and that issue was always in doubt.
Well, let me go to you, Bill Galston, because one of the criticisms of this Congress and perhaps even these negotiations is their either inability or the difficulty they have agreeing to grand bargains or to big issues. There are lots of little fixes that they seem to be able to do, but not to deal with the larger, perhaps even more systemic problems in our system.
Well, I think that criticism is substantially correct. And this most recent fiscal cliff aversion strategy has done little to dispel that fact, regrettably. Many of the larger fiscal issues that were supposed to drive these talks towards some sort of conclusion are still with us. The entire question of spending has been left unaddressed, and equally to the point, I think most of the question of the revenue needs of the country has been left on the table. There has been no move whatsoever towards tax reform, which I think serious members of both parties understand is an absolute necessity. And so I've read a newspaper article this morning putting the fiscal cliff deal up against three competing theories: the Keynesian theory, the supply-side theory, and the uncertainty theory, and judged it woefully wanting by all three of those competing standards. So the only thing you can say about the fiscal cliff deal that's good is that it could have been worse if nothing had happened.
Well, I was reading the CBO, and I guess it's, you know, quick calculations here, that this agreement, I guess, as it stands, still adds something like $4 trillion to the debt. And I know, Bill Galston, you're someone, and there are a lot of people concerned about the debt. Does that concern you?
Well, I wouldn't say that it realistically speaking, adds $4 trillion to the debt. What it does is make official what informed people have unofficially known for years now, namely that unless we were prepared to repeal or allow all of the Bush tax cuts to lapse, which the Republicans certainly weren't, and President Obama certainly was not, that our actual fiscal situation was $4 trillion worse than it appeared to be, according to the official calculation that the CBO by law must use. And CBO itself understood that that was a fraud, which is why for the past year and a half they've been preparing two envelopes, in effect, in their reports. One using the official legally mandated baseline, and the other their very realistic assessment of the political commitments that both parties had actually made and were not going to turn their back on. So it's not as though we're $4 trillion worse off than we were yesterday. If anything, we're a little better off because at least we know the truth now.
Well, let me quote something to you, Ross Baker, from Senator Tom Harkin, who is a critic of this, saying, if we're going to have some kind of a deal, the deal must be one that really does favor the middle class, the real middle class, those making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. That's the real middle class in America. The way this is, the taxes came down, you could be making $399,000 in this country and be middle class.
Yeah, I think that the original magic number, of course, was $250,000, and I think most Democrats were prepared to live with that, even though it certainly is considerably higher than the median income. But the president seemed to be willing, certainly fairly early on, to go to $400,000, and that I think set off a lot of alarm bells in liberal Democrats, people like Senator Harkin. And I think that the president's come in for a lot of criticism from the Democratic base because of that. I mean, I think there's a real kind of soak the rich constituency within the liberal Democratic base, and they're clearly very much unhappy with this.
But I notice, Bill Galston, that the stock market seems to be very happy with this. I don't have the numbers yet, but I can see that it's gone up today pretty dramatically. What does that tell us?
Well, what that tells me, among other things, is that a lot of the financial pundits were wrong in arguing that the stock market had already taken the high odds of a last-minute deal into account. When I left the house this morning, the market had just opened. It was up about 350 points. That tells me that a bunch of people were actually surprised by the deal and have responded very affirmatively. Having said that, I don't expect this to spark a long-term rally of the market because it doesn't change very much fundamentally. It has removed a self-inflicted wound from the financial system, and beyond that, I think it leaves our larger structural problems very much where they were.
And that's Bill Galston, William Galston, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. Also with us is Ross Baker, Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. And we are talking about the fiscal cliff negotiations, what it says about our state of politics in Washington, D.C. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to play another clip from the president's remarks of last night. The very end of, actually, I'm going to do clip number three. I'm saying this to my engineer here. Toward the end of his remarks last night, the president warned House Republicans that he would not accept a similar negotiating dynamic in advance of the coming deadline for raising the debt ceiling. Let's listen to the president.
Now, one last point I want to make. While I will negotiate over many things, I will not have another debate with this Congress over whether or not they should pay the bills that they've already racked up through the laws that they passed. Let me repeat. We can't not pay bills that we've already incurred. If Congress refuses to give the United States government the ability to pay these bills on time, the consequences for the entire global economy would be catastrophic, far worse than the impact of a fiscal cliff. People will remember back in 2011, the last time this course of action was threatened, our entire recovery was put at risk. Consumer confidence plunged, business investment plunged, growth dropped. We can't go down that path again.
Ross Baker, obviously the president drawing a line in the sand, taking us back to about a year and a half ago. Do you think he can and will hold firm on that?
Well, you know, the many Republicans, in the course of the weeks leading up to the vote on the fiscal cliff on New Year's Day, were saying that the battle over the debt limit extension would be a much better terrain for the Republicans to fight on. And I suspect that some Republicans, at least, were willing to support the fiscal cliff, both in the Senate and the fiscal cliff solution, both in the Senate and the House, because they feel that somehow conditions are going to be more auspicious at the end of February. Frankly, I don't see that. And the president has really become, you know, pretty categorical in his criticism of the Republicans who want to use that as the last ditch. I think that if in fact, there is a default at the end of February, I think that the president's in a pretty good position to blame it on the Republicans. I think that the public seems to have accepted pretty broadly the idea that it's Republican obstructionism that's caused these problems and has caused these decisions to have to be made at the last minute. So I certainly think that there's going to be at the end of February a very tense period in which, again, we're going to see the president trying to make the case that it's irresponsible and destructive to the image of the United States to have this happen.
Do you agree with that, Bill Galston, to be fighting once again over the debt ceiling?
Well, the president can say that he won't negotiate with that gun at his head, and I think I agree with him. But here's the problem. He can't order the Republicans not to proceed along that road. And there's no doubt about the fact that they do believe that it presents a better opportunity to take on what they regard as the most urgent issues than the fiscal cliff did. And so I find it difficult to believe that they won't try to push ahead in January and February. And so the fundamental question is the president prepared to hold the line, not to negotiate under those circumstances, and allow the United States to default technically on its debt? If you're gonna bluff, you better be prepared to have your bluff called. And I'm not sure that the president and the secretary of the treasury, whoever he is by February, will necessarily be comfortable with having that bluff called.
Just picking up on that and going back to you, Ross Baker, the president appears to be kind of a good poker player, but is he willing to play that high-level stakes of poker?
I think he feels emboldened by what's happened. I mean, I do agree with Bill it's a very risky thing to do to simply say I will not negotiate. I think that there would be some repercussions against the president were he to take that rigid and obdurate a stand. But I think that certainly, even though his negotiating style is still considered to be unusually soft and pliable to the Democratic base, I think he certainly has picked up some street cred as far as being a tough negotiator is concerned. And I think, certainly the Republicans do run a risk at the end of February of again appearing to be sort of nihilistic, I guess would be the best word to describe it.
But why? I mean, is it to prove a political point, Ross?
Well, the thing is, Marty, that, you know, that there is no national consensus. You know, we do live in a political era in which there are some very, very deep divisions in which people really do believe that, you know, the government spends much too much money, that it's profligate, And there are others who feel that the government is insufficiently aggressive in going after social problems and so on. I mean, these are legitimate divisions, and they reflect themselves in Congress. If members of Congress had the opportunity to choose their own colleagues, we might get different outcomes. But the public certainly said in the last election they liked what the president stood for. They strengthened the Democratic hand in the Senate, and they reduced only marginally the Republican strength in the House of Representatives. But there are Republicans who came to Washington feeling that they had a very strong mandate to hold the line on federal spending and actually try to reduce it. So these are genuine issues that are reflected in a public that's very much divided about which way. How big a government, how expensive a government they want to have, and how many dollars they're willing to lay out in taxes.
Let me get Lonnie from Berwyn to join us. Lonnie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is an all very interesting discussion on the process and the politics of which I'm a junkie and love it. However, it doesn't answer the question as to whether the debt ceiling is a function of bills and spending that Congress has already voted for versus what I heard today from a Republican who said that it is not money that Congress has voted for. So there's now a new spin on what the president said clearly last night, that you can't just not vote for something that has already been agreed to. If you make a charge on your credit card, you've got to pay that credit card bill, versus what I heard a Republican say today, which is that it is not money that is that Congress has already agreed to spend.
Well, Lonnie,
so can somebody clarify that?
Well, let me toss that to you, Bill Galston. Go ahead.
Well, I have not heard the Republican comment that your caller is referring to, but let me tell you what I think to be the truth of the matter.
we want the truth. Go ahead.
This is the way I see it.
That'd be refreshing.
And I think it's true to the law. The official debt ceiling establishes the amount of borrowing that the federal government is allowed to do. The federal government then sells Treasury securities to finance the operations of the government, and it is allowed to sell those Treasury securities up to the legally permitted debt ceiling, which we have now reached. But all of those securities have been issued pursuant to existing law, and they behind them stands the good faith and credit of the United States government. And that's what's at stake. It's not as though we're talking about issuing new securities. We are talking about honoring the debts that we have already incurred. So in that sense, I think I disagree with what this anonymous Republican is alleged to have said this
Well,
morning.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation and talk more with William Galston, Bill Galston, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and with Ross Baker, Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents British Isles of Wonder, Friday, January 11th in Verizon Hall. Bagpipes ring through the Highland air, a call to arms or adventure. The spirited pipes, drums, and dancers of Scotland's Black Watch and the Band of the Scots Guards join forces to celebrate the music and culture of England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. British Isles of Wonder, Friday, January 11th in Verizon Hall. Tickets available at KimmelCenter.org.
What's your name?
Django. The D is silent.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Quentin Tarantino about his new movie, Django Unchained. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Why does an insurance company pay $80 for a sling that you can get online for $7? We'll speak with a health economist about the real costs of procedures and medical equipment. Also, the drama in Washington continues to play out. How will it affect you? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the fiscal cliff negotiations, what they say about the state of affairs between Republicans and Democrats in Washington, D.C., and our political system, talking with William Galston, Bill Galston, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, one of the founders of No Labels, an organization of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. Their goal is to address the politics of problem solving. Ross Baker, Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He's a member of the board of contributors of USA Today, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ross, do you want to take a crack at that debt ceiling definition?
I think I'm going to defer to Bill Galston on budgetary issues. That's fair. Definitely his wheelhouse.
Fair enough. But so what? We understand, Bill, it sounds like the debt, it's to pay for what we've already spent, yes?
It's to pay, it's to honor the debt that we have already issued.
Right.
And on the assumption that the money that we got from selling those securities has already been spent, then yes, it's to pay for what we've already spent. But more precisely, it's like signing a mortgage and then making the principal and interest payments on the mortgage. We've signed the mortgage as a country, and now we have to pay it.
Fair enough.
The alternative is what's called default.
Right.
Now, there are countries around the world that have defaulted on their debt. I don't think we want to be one of them.
Let me quote something from Mickey Edwards to you, Ross Baker. This is something he wrote recently in The Atlantic. He says, ours is a system focused not on collective problem solving, but on the struggle for power between two private organizations. Party activists control access to the ballot through closed party primaries and conventions. Partisan leaders design congressional districts. Once elected to Congress, our representatives are divided into warring camps. Partisans decide what bills to take up, what witnesses to hear, what amendments to allow. I should add that Mickey Edwards a part of an endangered species, I would say, a moderate Republican who served in the U.S. Congress. Do you think he's on to something here?
Well, I know, you know, Mickey's recent book, of course, he takes the parties to task. Well, you know, we've always had political parties, even though they're not mentioned in the Constitution, and certainly the framers of the Constitution at least professed, you know, to abhor political parties. They developed pretty early. I think the problem is not the parties themselves, it's what the parties have become. They have become, I think, certainly in terms of things like primary elections, in which the most ideological members of people who identify with one party or the other, tend to be the dominant force and tend to send to Congress people who are, tend to be fairly inflexible, who really, you know, want to draw lines, want to make statements, such as, you know, people willing to have the country go into default. Mm-hmm. There is a constituency for that. It's not very large, I think, but there are people there who say, well, this is the only way that we can discipline federal spending is to go into default. And you know, that's very much like, you know, someone dreading going into surgery but deciding to commit suicide as a way to avoid it. I think it's not the parties themselves, but it's been, you know, the increasing deep-dyed ideology battles that have taken place with the parties as the arena for that.
Let me quote you to you, Bill Galston. You wrote something recently saying that your worry is not that the U.S. would end up like Greece. We don't have a similar system, but we would end up like Japan, quote, prosperous, debt-ridden, economically stagnant, and politically gridlocked.
Well, that pretty much sums up, you know, that's the sum of my fears, to quote Mr. Clancy. And, you know, I... first of all, I want to endorse emphatically something that Ross Baker said a couple of minutes ago. That is that Congress is not making up these political problems. Congress is, in many respects, a microcosm of the country as a whole. And not only are our political parties increasingly polarized, but my research and the research of many others indicates that the American people are increasingly polarized as well. We are deeply divided, and we're narrowly divided. Being deeply divided isn't a problem if one party has an overwhelming advantage, the way Roosevelt's party did during the New Deal. But if you're deeply divided and closely divided, then the political system, which is organized into competing parties, finds it very difficult to get to yes on anything of substance. That's where we are. And the result of that is a pretty debilitating policy gridlock that I think is carrying us farther and farther away from the kind of long-term course that we'd like to be on. And the question is, how can we turn where we are now into an opportunity to have the kind of discussion across party lines that will begin to steer us back towards where we need to be? The alternative, as I said in that piece, is to end up as a very large continental version of Japan, which I don't think anybody wants.
But we have, using the upper tax limit, there apparently was majority support among the public to raise taxes on people making over $250,000. What we ended up with, though, was a bill raising taxes on people making over $400,000 and for couples over $450,000. So it seems that the will of the people, if that's public opinion, was not reflected by what Congress and the president did, Bill.
Well, I don't entirely agree with that. I don't think the will of the people was organized around a specific number. The will of the people, I think, expressed itself as a general policy position, namely that the wealthiest Americans ought to be called upon to contribute more as their share of what needs to be done to help fix our fiscal problems. And so from that standpoint, the will of the people would have been contradicted if taxes had gone up sharply on the middle class. But as things now stand, there are provisions of the agreement last night that actually kick in well below $450,000 or $400,000, affecting, for example, the deductions that upper-income taxpayers are allowed to take from their gross income for purposes of taxation. So I think that one of the clearest majority results of the election was that the American people agreed with the president that taxes ought to go up on the rich. And that it was that clear public sentiment that finally forced the Republicans to give way on what for 22 years had been a matter of principle. So I see that as an example of democracy succeeding, not failing.
What are your thoughts, Ross?
Well, and I think the Republicans played into what I think was, I think, a general sense within the public that the rich had to pay their share. And I think that in some ways, the culminating event was the so-called vote on Plan B, which, of course, would have raised that limit to $1 million. And it put the Republicans in a very, very difficult position, and it gave them a tremendous amount of negative exposure by, in effect, saying, well, we're unwilling to raise taxes on anybody except those super rich making over $1 million, and to be a defender of the tax immunity of people making more than $1 million seems to me politically a very bad place for the Republicans to be. Now that all of this may be forgotten when we start dealing with the problems of the debt limit, but I think at least for the interim, I think the Republicans are seen as, in a sense, the best friends of plutocrats, and I just don't think that's politically very good for them.
Let me see what Herb from Mount Airy has to say. Herb, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So my question is whether there's a sign of hope in the 85 Republicans who defected from Eric Cantor and the conservative wing to vote with the Speaker, and that we might be able to count on that as a moderate wing emerging in the Republican Party that would that the president could count on when it comes to this debt ceiling discussion and other bipartisan challenges.
Herb, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Bill Galston, let me toss that to you.
My answer will, I think, not entirely please the caller.
Okay, fair enough.
Because my answer is yes and no. On the one hand, there is clearly a split in the Republican Party and even in the Republican leadership. Not only is there a big gap between Senate Republicans and House Republicans, but John Boehner voted for the deal, and his number two and number three, Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy, voted against it, and Paul Ryan voted for it. So the big four are split 2-2, and there is clearly what might be called a responsibility caucus within the House Republicans. And then there is what I will call the purist caucus. And right now the ratio seems to be 2/3 purists to 1/3 responsibility. These are my terms, obviously. But I doubt, that's the good news, I doubt very much that the divisions will be the same when the issue shifts from taxes to spending. The Republicans, I think, are united on the proposition that the major defect of what just happened was that it left the spending side of the equation entirely unaddressed. They're partly to blame for that, of course, because they didn't negotiate very well or very consistently. But I would very much doubt that the president will be able to mobilize 85 Republicans against major spending cuts in a couple of months.
Ross, let me ask you, because you worked with Harry Reid, was he sidelined by this deal that was worked out by Senator Mitch McConnell and Vice President Joe Biden?
Well, you know, it's really quite interesting because the Senate as an institution was on the sidelines for most of the battle. It was really, really up until the very last minute, an Obama-Boehner debate that was going on. But I think it reflects, I think, a reality about the Senate, and that is, of course, in the Senate the minority is empowered. That the Majority Leader Reid was pretty much on record as being behind the president, and so on. And the real stumbling block was Mitch McConnell in getting something that would be acceptable to the 44 Republicans in the 47 Republicans in the. In the Senate. So McConnell became a key player, and I think that McConnell was somebody who was in a very difficult position, particularly because he's up for re-election in 2014. He's only too acutely aware of what happened to his colleagues Robert Bennett from Utah and Richard Lugar from Indiana, who were defeated in Republican primaries by candidates running either with formal Tea Party endorsement or certainly from the right. So there was a lot of risk for him to get involved, but certainly the fact that he was willing to walk the plank, I think, gave to other Republicans and most unlikely Republicans, Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, the former head of the Club for Growth, and Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, people like that supporting it. It was an overwhelmingly bipartisan vote, and I think reflects the fact that the Senate is a place where the minority party, isn't just represented, just doesn't get the opportunity to speak on the floor, but plays a very, very important role in shaping legislation.
Let me get Jim from Reading to join us on Radio Times. And Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. My name is Jim, and thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I am concerned about the logjam in the House of Representatives, where the Tea Party and the right wing and the left wing cannot get together and agree on most things. And I think this is a result of something we put into the system which needs to be corrected. And it is the gerrymandering of each state so that all the representatives that come from these gerrymandered areas are either all right wing or left wing, and they don't talk to one another because they don't have to make a decision based on what is best for the country. It's only a decision based on what people in the in their areas agree to.
Well, Jim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Bill Galston, we have about a minute before I have to say goodbye. Can you respond to his comment?
Well, I'm no friend of gerrymandering, and I think it would be a lot better if every state did it the way states like Iowa do, with a nonpartisan commission. Having said that, I'll put my political scientist hat on for a minute. Gerrymandering is only a small piece of the problem. Regrettably, our population has sorted itself out, and people are now much more inclined than they ever were before to live near like-minded people. This is the, the name Bill Bishop called this the big sort. And so you have not only districts that are red or blue, but you have counties where the lines don't change that are getting redder and bluer, and you have states that are getting redder and bluer. So this kind of polarization is not a problem that nonpartisan congressional districting, which I support, can fully address.
Ross Baker, I'm giving you the last word here. So we have to figure out how to live with our political system?
Well, I think you have to make a distinction between the House and the Senate on this. That, you know, even Republican senators who represent states like Georgia and Tennessee understand that they've got constituencies that are much more diverse than any given Republican district in Tennessee or Georgia. So you're going to get a kind of moderating effect by the Senate, and that's the kind of thing, I think, that makes deals like this possible.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ross Baker, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And William Galston, Bill Galston, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
And go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of the show, but stay with us. We'll be right back.